I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's been an ugly political morning. Lipstick Bungle is the headline in the New York Daily News today, and the McCain campaign's newly formed Palin Truth Squad has accused Barack Obama of referring to Sarah Palin when criticizing John McCain's policies. Barack said this.
You know, you can put lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig.
The McCain camp, led by former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, called that comment disgraceful, said Obama owed Palin an apology, and today McCain released a new web ad that asks of Obama, ready to lead? No. Ready to smear? Yes. But this morning, Barack Obama responded that the McCain campaign was using lies, phony outrage, and Swift boat politics. Obama said the entire context of his comment was comparing John McCain's economic policies to George Bush's, and besides, McCain used the same phrase last year when describing Hillary Clinton's health care plans.
I think they put some lipstick on the pig, but it's still a pig.
All this as the ground shifts. The latest polls show John McCain now has a 52-41% edge among white woman voters. We'll have a conversation about polling and why that distinction might be important. But first, Mark Halperin is a political analyst for Time Magazine and ABC News. Mark, people tell us they want to hear about issues, but this lipstick thing, it seems silly, but is it damaging to either candidate?
Robin, don't take this personally, but I'm embarrassed for our profession today. I'm embarrassed that you're asking about it. And I'm embarrassed that it's dominating the media coverage. We're less than 2 months away from Election Day. This is a phony thing ginned up by crocodile tears from the Republicans. I'm not an advocate for either side. I'm an advocate for the public interest. And the public interest suggests that we should stop talking about it. It's interesting as a matter of strategy. I no doubt that the McCain campaign is doing a brilliant job, but they're being aided and abetted every second we spend discussing this.
Well, then let's move on. All polls show that the two candidates are overall in a statistical tie. The Wall Street Journal poll today that I mentioned also had good news for Obama, more voters identifying with his values and background, more are comfortable with him as president and commander-in-chief than they said they were in a poll 3 weeks ago. What do you attribute that to?
Well, both these candidates are pretty popular. We've got two candidates who are pretty well-liked, and whose the views of the voters of them on a range of issues are pretty positive.
Well, you know, and you say if in fact it calms down, again, let's not go back to lipstick, but do you think it will? I mean, you know, some have said that Barack Obama needed to show some fire, needed to respond to what you are calling the, you know, the phony ginned up issue of, for instance, lipstick on a pig or a pit bull, I think was the reference during the convention. Do you think that this is just a phase we're moving through?
I think the Obama campaign is rocked back on its heels and somewhat discombobulated. Sarah Palin has turned out politically to be a very strong, dynamic-changing pick for John McCain. I think, most importantly, it has shored up his support, not nationally, because the national polls don't really matter. What matters is in the key states. I think a lot of the so-called red states that George Bush won, that John McCain was playing defense in, he has shored up. And if that happens, if Palin's had that effect over the longer term, that's a very big development because it means we're back to the battleground states we've seen in the last couple of elections, and John McCain doesn't have to worry as much about defending some of the southern and western states where Obama planned to play strong. Obama needs to get back in control of his public image. He needs to be defining himself for the voters rather than being defined by the Republicans. Palin has made that very difficult. She is the hot story now, and she could be the hot story all the way through Election Day, and that makes Obama's ability to define himself on his own terms very, very difficult.
Well, Thomas Friedman writes in the New York Times today that global cooling has taken over the campaign trail, that Palin now has the gut connection with voters that Obama had. But how does that square with what we heard Peggy Noonan, unfortunately, she was caught speaking off microphone during the conventions and before Palin's speech, she said that it was a real problem for the Republican Party that it had picked somebody who had a narrative, who had a story, that it was about her story, that that never worked for Republicans. It would seem to be working.
I think that the biggest problem with the pick remains a substantive one. We'll see if Governor Palin in her interview with Charlie Gibson on Thursday of ABC News out in Alaska starts to allay concerns that some people have had, including some Republicans I know, who believe that it's a pick that was based on politics, not a pick based on the substance, which is really the requirement that any presidential nominee has. As a matter of politics, though, the narrative, I think one of the things Peggy might have been underestimating, and frankly I did too, is the age in which we live. Sarah Palin is a fascinating figure for a variety of reasons, and the current media culture can take each piece of that fascination, some positive, some negative, some neutral, and spin it out over a long period of time. McCain, Biden, Obama, now very familiar figures, not as interesting to the press and to large segments of the public. So think Peggy was probably more right than not at the time, but a lot has happened in the very short period of time since then.
And we have a very short period of time relatively to the elections. If, in fact, it turns back to issues, what do you think they are?
Well, the economy, energy, health care are the big issues on the voters' minds. And while there are some differences between them, it is difficult to necessarily have the rigorous public debate we need, in part because Obama turned down those town meetings that McCain wanted, but also because they don't disagree as much as some people would like to have you think.
Well, we, by the way, have heard from an analyst that one of the reasons that Obama turned down those town meetings is that it locks him into a certain date and a certain time and a certain place and keeps him from traveling to these pockets where he might win over votes in person.
McCain would have done the town meetings anywhere Obama wanted. It's a phony argument, along with the many other phony arguments they made, and I think in the end they may regret the decision. They've now built up the debate so much that if Obama performs poorly, it may be decisive.
Mark Halperin, editor-at-large and senior political analyst for Time magazine, also political analyst for ABC News. Mark, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, today Barack Obama is in Virginia, his running mate Joe Biden in Nashua, New Hampshire. John McCain and Sarah Palin are in Fairfax, Virginia. And then she's expected to head back to Alaska, despite reports that the McCain campaign is nervous that she'll take the huge crowds with her. Mark Halperin just said she is the hot story. Well, our next guest says that's no longer true. Pollster John Dogby says the presidential race is now between the tops of the tickets and who can bring change to a changing electorate. Dogby has compiled thousands of interviews and several years of research. He says despite the country's reputation for overconsumption and despite, or maybe because of, U.S. wars and an uncertain economy, America is in the midst of a fundamental reorientation toward a new global citizenry, which is learning to adjust to a world of limited resources, among other shifts. The full title of the book, The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. And John Zogby joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And, you know, so I've made the nod to your book. So now tell us who's going to win in November.
Oh, boy, that's above my pay grade. This is so hotly competitive. But let me frame it,
yeah,
if I could. You've got, on one hand, the literally and figuratively the face of the future, a new globalism, an agent for change, Barack Obama, the new Jack Kennedy. On the other hand, you've got someone two generations earlier who represents an earlier America of sacrifice and patriotism and America first. That's John McCain, a.k.a. Harry Truman. Look at that. Jack Kennedy versus Harry Truman. Does it get better than that?
Well, and then standing right behind them, you have Joe Biden from hardscrabble roots and Sarah Palin, who many people listening to your introduction of Barack Obama would have said, mm-hmm, oh, is he speaking of Sarah Palin? The Republicans are also calling her agent of change.
Well, you know, you've got four very authentic American characters, each with his and her own story.
Let's go to some more recent polling data. On September 6th, you noted the McCain-Palin post-convention bump, mm-hmm, Palin unifying the Republican base, attracting men to the ticket. But you wrote then that Palin wasn't helping with likely independent female voters. In fact, you said that the ranks of undecided independent women had shrunk from 15% to 7%, and they were all going for Obama. Then 2 days later, a Washington Post ABC News poll has McCain up 12% among white women, surging past the 8% edge that Obama held with these same women before the GOP convention. Did you miss something?
No, but I'd certainly like to ask the Washington Post ABC if they did. No, frankly, we're talking apples and oranges here, because the numbers you and I just talked about in my poll are about independent women, and ABC Washington Post is addressing white women. The very fact that Sarah Palin helped John McCain consolidate the base of the Republican Party, where McCain is now getting 91% of Republican support, 92-93% of conservative support, includes a significant number of white women who were Republican and conservative women who had questions about John McCain and who now, because of the choice of Sarah Palin, are with the McCain ticket. I was addressing simply independent women.
Who were not necessarily conservative, liberal, just hadn't struck out in either direction yet.
That's right.
And you say that there are fewer of them.
There are fewer of them, interestingly. And yeah, Sarah Palin, in this instance, seems to have driven some of those independent women over into the Obama camp. All of which makes elections so fascinating when you get these cross currents taking place.
Well, just to, you know, sort of do a checklist of some of the things you're finding in recent polling, and this, what do you call this, this new American dream, this idea that people are thinking more globally, they want more diplomacy, the public wants the country to be a force but not use force in the world. They believe in man's role in global warming. Even evangelicals increasingly believe that man has played a role in global warming, and they think they have a role in addressing the issue. The coalition of angry Christians in sharp retreat, you write. People may not like abortion, but they don't want to get rid of Roe v. Wade. So how do you explain that in the last couple weeks they have, in large numbers, embraced an anti-choice woman who isn't sure that man had a hand in global warming, wants creationism taught alongside evolution, is part of a team that is probably the more aggressive as far as maybe putting aside diplomacy for military might? Can you do all the polling in the world? And along comes a Sarah Palin that Americans just like, and all your polling goes out the window.
No. Remember, all of this was in the context to the lead-up to the Republican convention. There was the focus. Where is Sarah Palin liked? Within the walls of the convention center in St. Paul and among conservatives. And there are enough Republicans and conservatives out there consolidating 90-plus percent behind McCain-Palin to make this a competitive race. But now, what we will discover is that the race is back on. Sarah Palin and Joe Biden are relegated out to the blue highways and out to, you know, the smaller towns and the smaller rallies. This race is between Barack Obama, part of a new demographic and global future, and a John McCain, who represents an earlier generation of the United States first, of sacrifice, and of an older form of patriotism. That's the choice. Now, with that said, these two gentlemen will battle for the middle, and they already have, and this is where we will determine the outcome of this election. But the outcome of this election doesn't determine totally the outcome of the future trends. Remember, we have two candidates who embrace global warming. We have two candidates who embrace a more centrist philosophy and health care and immigration reform, recognizing multiculturalism within the United States. The John McCain candidacy is different from the George W. Bush candidacy, and for that matter, the Bob Dole candidacy of 12 years ago, and the Barack Obama candidacy is a wave of the future, regardless of who wins. And who will win is mainly to do with who Americans believe bring change. But America will get change, and it's not about Sarah Palin anymore.
Well, we'll see. That's pollster John Zogby. His new book is The Way We'll Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. We're going to come back to hear what advice he'd give to the candidates and learn about this future of the electorate. He said we should be paying to the youngest voters. He calls them the first globals. Also later today, the absolute tragedy in post-Hurricane Haiti. Back in a minute, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with pollster John Zogby. His new book, The Way We'll Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. And John, we should say you poll for corporations and for both sides of the political aisle. For Democrats, you tell a great story of Al Gore calling you the Monday before Election Day 2000 asking, am I going to win? And you said, well, it depends on Florida. You also polled for Republican strategist Grover Norquist in 2000. Now, you had discovered the trend of average Americans investing in stocks, something previously left to the very rich. And your results helped Norquist and President Bush craft the phrase ownership society. They then used that to push for plans to get citizens to invest in their own health care or retirement. They'd invest their Social Security funds, for instance. That plan failed. But if the presidential candidates were paying you today, and neither is, what would you want to tell them about this election?
Essentially, to respect the American people and respect the fact that the American people get it. Americans have adjusted to an era of limits, much more so than we think. For some, 27%, they're working at a job that pays less. Respect the fact that they have difficult choices that need to be made in their lives, and they are making them. They've readjusted their expectations, readjusted the American dream. They're now much more about trying to live a fulfilling life within the context of modest expectations. There's also something else at play that I want the candidates to be aware of, and that is we baby boomers, those of us contemplating our adult life and pre-retirement or early retirement, we now have to come to grips with the fact that we've got 25 to 35 more years of healthy living ahead of us. What is it we want to do? And Americans more and more in this category are saying, I don't want to be known for what I did on my job. I want to learn. I want to travel. I want to teach. I want to do something that's more meaningful.
Of the demographic groups you identify, I want to talk about one because it seems to contradict what you've just said. Because you say candidates should really pay attention to young people. These are the 18 to 29-year-olds. You call them first globals, because they assume they're going to live around the world. But you also write that they're materialistic and self-absorbed. They want to look richer than they are and are obsessed about relationships. So how does that square with the other American you were describing?
That's a great question. Well, look, there are two things that define an age cohort. One is the life cycle. That's how old they are. And basically, 20-somethings are 20-somethings. They are consumed with themselves and the very personal and intimate relationships, career.
And always have
sort
been.
Of them.
Always
and
have.
Always
been.
Have
yeah.
And always will be. But there's also the historical era in which they are 20-somethings that defines who they are. So the greatest generation that Tom Brokaw writes about were just as self-centered and just as concerned with the intimate details, but history made them sacrifice and history made them the greatest generation. What I'm saying is that this group is planetary. They're just as likely to call themselves citizens of the planet Earth as they are citizens of the United States. They're not necessarily the smartest 20-somethings we've ever had. Mm-hmm. They may not be able to find Darfur on the map. The difference is they know that there is a Darfur. And that in itself, number one, is something that they will carry with them into their 30s and into their 40s. And secondly, it's also something that defines them as our first real global citizens.
Well, and you write, clients of yours like IBM were so excited about hearing about this group that they are trying to set up a symposium to introduce them to the idea of, you know, working in a globally integrated enterprise. But I just want to push a little more on that, because you write a majority of these first globals think the 2000 election was stolen by the Republicans. Mm-hmm. But you write that they're not liberal in the political sense. It's more in the sense of the dictionary definition of open-minded. They're open-minded. They don't want abortion banned, but they think abortion may be immoral most of the time. So who are they voting for?
Right now, in strong ways, they are for Barack Obama. This group is less wedded to existing institutions or traditions in American history. So we often criticize them, oh, you don't know segregation. They haven't lived with as much segregation as older age cohorts have. They live in a diverse and multicultural world. And to them, Barack Obama isn't the African-American candidate for president. He's the cool candidate for president. He's the face of America's future because he's the face to a great degree of many of their friends and classmates and coworkers, something that previous generations have not experienced as they have.
You also use a polling technique called New Retail Politics, traveling voter preferences based on where people shop. Why is that?
We started tracking Walmart shoppers, frequent Walmart shoppers, and people who never shop at Walmart. And then what we discovered is that Latinos who shop at Walmart are more conservative than Latinos who don't, and African Americans who shop at Walmart are more conservative than African Americans who don't. We were on to something. So I just wanted to know about the broad spectrum of preferences where people shop. And what we got was, on one hand, very, very liberal people on the issues and in voting preferences. And from left to center, Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale's, Macy's. In the center, we had Boscov's, Marshall, and Target. And then way to the right was Walmart. And then moving right to center, Walmart, Sears, JCPenney, and I just found it to be fascinating and a key indicator of people's ideological preferences and their voting habits. And what was intriguing is the last time I did this, I just did it actually about a month ago, what we were finding was a decided shift of Target and Marshall's previously centrist voters well over to Obama. Now, we're going to repeat that in the next couple of weeks, now that the race is as close as it is, and see if they've shifted towards the center or even, for that matter, preferring John McCain.
All right. Well, we'll see as we watch it unfold with you, John Zogby, and watch it you will. John Zogby, of course, the pollster. His new book is The Way We'll Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. John, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Robin. Great to talk to you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, an epic poem inspired by Dante and 9/11. And the man who was in charge of the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund says he will never again put more value on one life than another. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Haiti, after the news, Here and Now. The view of Haiti from the air is astonishing. People living on rooftops, if they're lucky to have them, massive flooding. The bodies are harder to see from the air. Corpses in the fields of the town of Gonaive and on the concrete sidewalks in nearby Cabaret, as this devastated country struggles to recover from four back-to-back hurricanes. The official death toll is over 300, but many say the true toll will not be known. So many bodies swept out to sea. Impassable roads, crumbled bridges, and all this flooding make it impossible for aid workers even to assess the damage. Jacqueline Charles covers Haiti for the Miami Herald. She was born in Turks and Caicos and is of Haitian descent. We apologize. She spoke to us earlier on a scratchy cell phone from Port-au-Prince. It's hard to hear, and her descriptions of Haiti's ravaged conditions may also be difficult to hear for younger listeners, but she gives compelling eyewitness account. She was the only reporter to accompany Prime Minister Michel Pierre-Louis on a flight over the country, and we asked her what she saw.
It was very interesting because this was Prime Minister Michel Pierre-Louis and U.S. Ambassador Janet Sanderson's first look, you know, at the country, at the devastation. And the first thing that you saw was just the rice fields that were just buried underwater, I mean, almost unrecognizable. There was a huge lake throughout everywhere in the Artibonite Valley. The Artibonite Valley is the rice bowl of Haiti, and it feeds essentially 9 million people. And today, to look at that, and this is what the Prime Minister was looking at, rice fields just covered with water, completely unrecognizable. And then as you moved, you saw the cornfields. You saw the banana fields toppled over. This country right now is facing a huge, huge food crisis. I know we've been talking about Haiti and the food crisis since April, but whereas April, the issue was about affordability, whether Haitians could afford to buy the food. Today, there is no food. Also, rivers, just muddy, filthy rivers that are still just gushing out to sea. And then where the water has started to recede, you just see mud. I mean, the country looks like one big mud pie. You're asking yourself, can it be cleaned up? And then you see the people just still fighting the mud in the streets. Just rivers of mud where there used to be streets. That's what the city looks like right now.
Well, Jacqueline, you were also on the ground. In fact, I think you were the only international reporter in Cabaret right after that city was devastated by Hurricane Ike. And you describe scenes of, you know, children, drowned children just lying on concrete slabs.
We went to Cabaret in search of eight children who had allegedly drowned in a house when the floods came, when Ike pounded that community, which is just north of Port-au-Prince. But before I could even find those children, as soon as I hit the town, people were saying, here's a dead person. Go around that corner. There's another dead person. Go around that corner. Every corner, it seemed, there was a dead person. There was one woman. She was 24 years old, the mother of two. And what her neighbor said was that she was inside the house when the waters came. The water just started gushing through her door. She grabbed her two kids and she started to run. And between the rain and the river that spilled its banks, it just swept the children out of her arms. They found her, but they had not found her children. And someone basically, the river brought her body downstream. Someone saw her. They picked her up, put her on a wooden plank, and basically laid her on the side of the street. And then there were the children. What happened with the babies, they were found the same way. To hear residents tell you, one river brought babies down and another river brought old women down. And when they found the babies, I think one person found the baby, brought the baby there, and then suddenly it became the holding spot for these children. I'm looking at them, and at first I'm thinking to myself, wow, they, you know, porcelain dolls, because that's what you have to tell your mind, because to sit there, 12 children ages 1 to 8, all victims of this hurricane, and when you look at the rivers basically came inland more than 200 yards, swallowed up entire homes. You're talking to residents, and they're pointing to you where their house was, and you're saying, well, I don't see it, because there's no foundation, there's no wall, there's not a pot, there's not a bed, there's nothing left. Just this empty spot. And in Gonaib, you know, I saw people walking in the mud, and I walked in the mud, and it was waist high at times, but the water hadn't started to reveal the dead bodies. But you walk in Cabaret, and you could walk, and people were walking around as if they've just emerged from a war zone, and all you saw were dead bodies.
Well, Jacqueline, we know the U.S. military is helping deliver food and medical aid through helicopters that are coming in from ships offshore. The U.N. Agency for International Development is donating money. There's been a very difficult time in delivering any relief, and there's a hope that they can get straws in, these water straws that we hear about that are being used around the world, that would at least clean the water so that people can drink it. But part of Haiti's problem for a couple decades now has been its complete deforestation. It would seem that one more hurricane is going to wipe this country off the map. Is there any discussion, you were with the Prime Minister, any discussion of maybe even moving the population of Haiti? How can they survive another storm?
Well, Michel Pierre-Louis was very clear in a very extensive interview with me yesterday. Her first priority is getting food and water to the people in order to prevent any more deaths. But at the very top of her list, the priority is addressing this environmental issue in this country, because in her words, if we don't do something, if we as Haitians don't do something, we are going to disappear one day. The Port-au-Prince, the capital of this country, was spared, but if the rains that came to Gonaïves, that came to Lekai, that came to Jacmel, if those rains come to Port-au-Prince, the entire hills can come washing down. And what she argues that a lot of people focus on deforestation, but the problem with Haiti is not just deforestation. It's not the charcoal. It is the fact that when you look into the hills, you see people building houses on slopes. People are building plantations on slopes, and it's government land. And basically, decades of political turmoil in this country, bad governance, has basically meant that there's been no planning, no urban planning. You look at the rivers and people are building their houses on the riverbanks. The banks are weak. The hills are weak. As we were going through to Cabaret, our car got stuck in a river. I mean, but it was a river of a mudslide that was leading out into the ocean. And you're looking at it, and it's everything just coming, soil coming down from the hills. And so what she is basically advocating and pushing right now is that there are environmental laws that have been worked on but have never been passed, and that it's time for Parliament to start to work on this, to pass these laws, and that it's time for Haitians, every individual Haitian, to take this issue seriously, because the rains are not going to stop. The hurricanes are not going to stop. If they've always been around, why is it now, in the last 4 years, you know, we had Jeanne with more than 300,000 deaths, and today, even if we don't reach that number, the devastation is also clear, that it's time for Haitians to get serious about this environment and start thinking about how do they save themselves.
Jacqueline Charles covers Haiti for the Miami Herald. As we said, she's of Haitian descent, and she's in Port-au-Prince. Jacqueline, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And just a reminder, if you ever want to, you can always download a podcast of our broadcast and take us with you wherever you go. Just go to here-now.org for this and any other story to hear it again. You're listening to Here Now. Well, and we just heard journalist Jacqueline Charles ask, why are we having so many storms? Why are they so devastating? But it's another question, are they more devastating? As Hurricane Ike strengthens entering the Gulf of Mexico today, we wanted to check into the debate over global warming and hurricanes. Dr. Kerry Emanuel is a climate scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's been rethinking the issue as well. In 2005, right before Hurricane Katrina, he wrote a paper that predicted rising hurricane intensity because of global warming. This spring, he released a new study that raises questions about how hurricane strength and frequency relate to global warming. Now, the first study was seized upon by the left as evidence of human impact on global warming. Now the right sees the new study as supporting their view that human impact doesn't cause global warming. The right-leaning Business and Media Institute wrote the new study shows global warming could lead to fewer hurricanes. So Professor Emanuel joins us now. Professor, be clear. What are you thinking now?
Well, to be quite honest with you, we're a little bit confused by the various data that we look at. My 2005 paper was based on a careful analysis of storms in the North Atlantic and North Pacific oceans, in which we saw quite a large increase in the power of the storms that goes along very, very closely with fluctuations in the temperature of the tropical oceans. These fluctuations are caused by many factors, both man-made and natural. On the other hand, when we run climate models out into the future, we see only very modest increases going forward. And there is a contradiction, and we're trying to figure that out.
Well, and you weren't the only one to make the claim that warmer waters made more intense storms. And by the way, that makes sense, because the warmer the water, the more quickly the thinking was that it would evaporate up into storms. The 2008 Georgia Climate Summit made the link between warmer ocean temps and increased hurricane activity. Florida State says that since the 80s, winds have become stronger in the strongest hurricane. You're a scientist, and I know you want to look at the evidence, but what do you say to people who said it feels like the storms are worse?
Well, the theory is pretty well settled on this, that as you make the oceans warmer, storms do become more intense. And we have seen quite a bit of evidence that this is so. The debate is just on how much more intense. Also, the issue of how many storms might occur. At least in the Atlantic, we're also seeing more storms as the ocean temperature goes up. But in models, we actually see the opposite. As you warm the climate with greenhouse gases, the number of storms tends to either stay the same or maybe even drop a little bit. So those are the areas in which there is some disagreement among scientists, and the evidence itself is somewhat confusing.
And to be clear, Professor Emanuel, because you know the conversation gets so clouded, as we said, by politics, what is your, in this moment, thinking about the impact of climate change on hurricanes?
We are quite convinced by both observations and theory that global warming is increasing the intensity of hurricanes, particularly at the high end. We're seeing more Cat 3s, 4s, and 5s. But on other aspects of the problem, whether the number of hurricanes will go up or down, that remains unresolved. We're also very concerned about something that we all see in the data and in, particularly in theory, and that is a given hurricane, as the climate warms, will cause more rain. And in places like Haiti and in Honduras during Hurricane Mitch, a lot of the deaths result from freshwater flooding. And so that's another place that we need to focus our concern.
So when people who've seized on your recent work, say, for instance, as the Business and Media Institute did, quote you as saying that hurricane activity will actually decrease because of global warming, they say that that's your conclusion. You would say what?
Well, I would say that they somewhat misleadingly quoted me or misquoted me on that. Globally, at least one study shows that the frequency of storms slightly drops. But that's global. That's not the Atlantic. Most of the models show it going up rather substantially in the Atlantic. And in the end of the day, it's not just the frequency of storms we're interested in. The Cat 1s and Cat 2s hardly do any damage at all. It's the upper range that we're concerned about, and all the available evidence is that that's going up.
Dr. Kerry Emanuel, climate scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Okay, in just 1 minute, theater for kids in the Twin Cities. In 1 minute, here and now.
C. Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis is a hive of activity. Last week, two world premieres were rehearsing simultaneously. Madeline and the Gypsies, created in collaboration with the Circus Juventus, a performing arts school in the Twin Cities.
But we smile at the good.
As well as a new production of Peter Pan with shadow puppets created by Italian master Fabrizio Montecchi and a script adapted from the J.M. Barrie novel by Scottish director Douglas Irvine.
Come and fly with me, Wendy.
Fly?
Yes, come and fly with me and tell the other boys.
I can't. What about Mother? Besides, I can't fly.
I'll teach you. Yes, I'll teach you to jump on the wind's back and away we'll go. Wendy, just think, when you're sleeping in your bed at night, you could be out flying with me instead, touching the stars.
Well, when we were at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, we were so impressed by the number of arts organizations in the Twin City area, just to name a few: the Guthrie Theater, the Ordway and Walker Arts Centers, the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, and, of course, the Children's Theater Company, which won the 2003 Tony for Outstanding Regional Theater and which serves over 300,000 young people in programs a year. We sat down with the CTC's artistic director, Peter Brocious, to talk about the company and the thriving arts and culture scene of the Twin Cities.
What they say about this place is, you know, in corporate recruiting terms, is that often they say it's the hardest place to get people to move to and the hardest place to get people to move from. Because once they get here, they see that, you know, we are filled with parks and bike trails and nature is, you know, a step away. But for those who also, you know, want the great pleasures of the arts and music and the choral music scene here and the visual arts, it's a very vibrant community.
What is it in particular about this theater that won the Tony in 2003 that is so thriving? What is the heartbeat of this particular theater?
I think it's commitment to excellence and the fact that it has continually brought artists who are the leading artists in the American theater and the international theater to make their best work, to make work for young people that is surprising, theatrical, never condescends, and the standards are, exceed the standards of most American theaters.
Give us some examples, for instance, you're rehearsing Peter Pan now,
right,
and Madeline. Okay, so Peter Pan, we get that, but what's something else that might have been shown here that someone might not immediately say, oh, that's children's theater?
Well, later this season, we're doing a piece on Iqbal, which is a piece about child labor in Pakistan. We've also done pieces on Janusz Korczak, who was an amazing figure who was a leader in the Warsaw Ghetto during the Second World War. You know, we've done pieces about the tension between the African-American and Somali communities right here in the Twin Cities, which were truly dividing those communities, and we felt it was important to do that. And we've done pieces on the Lost Boys of the Sudan. Spent 4 years researching, you know, here and in Fargo, where there's a huge Sudanese community. So when you ask the question, you know, what defines the work of this theater, often young people are central. Often their situation is central. Some of their concerns, their problems, their stories, their fantasy, their humor is central. But it's created by artists of the highest caliber, and we simply challenge them to do nothing less than make the best theater they've ever made.
How do you do this? Because we're in a gorgeous building. You share space with the art museum, the same structure, but still, your portion is pretty darn big. We're sitting in a huge atrium lobby. There's a lot of money invested here, probably not as much as you need, but there's a lot. So how does towns that might even have more income struggle to support theater, how do you do it here?
I think the Twin Cities has for years seen the extraordinary value of cultural institutions in building community, in bringing individuals to move here, in retaining corporations, and creating a kind of vitality of civic life that needs to be supported and wants to be supported.
But how much of this is supported by the city, and how much is private?
We have terrific state support. We have no city support. We have incredible foundation support. And we have incredible corporate and individual support across this region, as well as national support. So what's amazing here is that you have an ethos which truly says that to be a corporate citizen, you need to be involved in the community. And so the vast majority of corporations are actively supporting the arts, see the value, and have their leaders on the arts boards, are involved, contribute, see that what we do is valuable, not only because in this case we serve children and we're in partnership with schools and we're helping teachers and we're working in some of the toughest neighborhoods, but that it adds value to us all. There was an amazing moment a few years ago where, there were about $600, $650 million of major cultural capital campaigns. All of them succeeded. All the buildings are open. We have ours, the Walker, the Guthrie, et cetera, brand new library. And this city made it a priority. I mean, one of the great things in my profession is that we have people flying in perhaps once a month from cities across the country saying, how do we have something like the Children's Theater Company in our city? And we're happy to help sponsor, because we know when you have an arts organization like the Children's Theater Company that brings kids into a professional facility that gives them extraordinary experiences, well, they're going to appreciate the symphony, the art museum. They'll have seen beautiful light and image and language. And, we see ourselves as a great birthing place, incubator for a love of the arts for families and for young people.
I'm curious. I would ask this if the Democrats were having their convention here as well. The Republicans are. If you could be one of the workshops that they have during the day instead of the corn growers, if you got to have a caucus one afternoon, what would you want to say to them?
I would lead workshops to let them experience the power of their own imaginations, to let them experience what the power of the arts means to a group of people, so they can see this is not something on the periphery. This is not something that should be on the sides of education. How core this is to what it means to be a citizen in this century, that we have to build collaboration skills. We have to build curiosity. We have to build the ability to work with people who are different than who we are, and that there's an incredible discipline that happens through the arts that is transformative, that creates the citizens who are going to be able to live and create in this next century. We are not a nation of products. We're a nation of ideas now, and we must be able to harness curiosity, imagination, invention, risk-taking, and the theater does all of that. It puts us in the shoes of another person. It creates empathy. It creates understanding. And in a world this small, this connected, if we don't know how to do that, we're in a dangerous situation.